Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Never did those words seem so profoundly true as the night when three of us came down from the Acrocorinth in southern Greece, one night in which the stars were out in full majesty. And almost spontaneously, we broke out into the old Christian folk song, "In the Stars, His Handiwork I See." And in our minds, we were thinking, what could possibly compare to God's creation of the universe? Well, there are some people who believe that they have discovered something every bit as significant as the creation of the world. They're called Christians. You may have heard of them. One of the first was a fisherman by the name of John, son of Zebedee. He was confident that the life, death, and return from death of a man called Jesus of Nazareth was of such cosmic and eternal significance that it was like a new creation, a whole new beginning. So when he put down on parchment the story of Jesus, he intentionally imitated the opening words of the book of Genesis, "In the beginning." More specifically, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. God created everything through him. These verses are part of what is called the prologue of the Gospel of John. The prologue, chapter 1, the first 18 verses. You just heard them read aloud. The prologue. Now, this may have been an ancient Christian hymn. It may have been an early Christian song that John adapted to put at the beginning of his Gospel to kind of summarize the contents that follow. He begins by introducing Jesus as the Logos. In John's day, both Jews and non-Jews influenced by Greek culture would have resonated with this word, Logos. For Jews, Logos meant word. And it would remind them that God created all things through his word. Genesis 1:3, "Then God said, let there be light. And there was light." For Greeks, logos meant reason. The universe had a magnificent order to it. What produced that? The Logos is responsible for the majestic order of the world. And it's the Logos that enables human beings to think rationally, to reason. So this Greek word, Logos, is usually translated as word in English translations of the New Testament. John is using this term to express something about the reality of Jesus to both Jews and Gentiles, a very broad audience. In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. John identifies Jesus Christ as the Word, as the Logos. And as such, John can attribute to him such attributes as creation and giving life, attributes normally associated with God. John intends that the whole of his gospel be read in the light of John 1:1. If you don't remember anything else I say today, try to remember that one. John intends for his whole gospel to be read, and I do hope you read through the whole gospel during this series. John intends that we read the whole gospel in light of this first verse. The actions and the words of Jesus are the actions and the words of God. Now, few would dispute that Jesus has had more influence on the world than any other historical figure. Most of what we know about Jesus is found in the four New Testament books called the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, the Gospels are not to be understood as complete biographies, all right? That's not their intent. But they are historically based proclamations of the person and the work of Jesus. Our word gospel comes from an old English word, Godspell. You may remember many years ago there was a musical about the life of Jesus called Godspell. Now, Godspell simply means good news. And that is a translation of the New Testament word euangelion. Oh, I know, this is horrible, isn't it? All these terms. But euangelion does come into English. It becomes evangelism or evangelist. Any form of that word comes from euangelion. But euangelion itself was not new. I mean, the Greeks had been using it for centuries to refer to the report about a significant event. It might be, say, the birth of a king, and that report would go out. Or it might be a great victory in battle, and that report would go out. Well, John and the other gospel writers knew that the story of Jesus was even more significant. So his was not just a gospel, but the gospel. This was not just a report. This was the report. This is the greatest report that the earth could ever receive. Now, for nearly 19 centuries, Christians have used four symbols to represent the four gospels. And these symbols are taken from the Old Testament, from the book of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel had a vision of a heavenly creature with four faces. A heavenly creature with four faces. Okay, I know it's hard to imagine this. Human, ox, lion, and eagle. Human, ox, lion, eagle. Four faces. And so the early Christians thought of the message concerning Jesus Christ as being a heavenly story with four faces. The human face is for Matthew. The ox for Luke. The lion represents Mark. And the eagle is the symbol for John. Now, these four pictures stood for the Gospels, and each was recognized by its symbol, even by those who could not read and write. Equally, this imagery was used to communicate a summary of the message of each gospel. So even if people couldn't read and write, they would see the symbol. It would remind them of the main content. So the story is simple. Jesus was born as a human being, sacrificed like an ox, rose triumphant like a lion, and ascended like an eagle. See? Now, the eagle has two proverbial qualities that make it the ideal symbol for John. The answer out of the whirlwind that the Lord gives Job speaks to this. This is from the book of Job. Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes its nest on high? From there it spies the prey, its eyes see it from far away. So there's this quality of vision. And as for its vision, biologists tell us that an eagle's brain has devoted 7 times more to sight than human beings. So in other words, eagles can see what the rest of us cannot. This is also true of John. Like a sharp-eyed eagle, John sees deeply into the heart of Jesus. He's known as the beloved disciple who was especially close to Jesus. And whereas the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, give us a kind of a photograph of Jesus, John, the artist, paints this intimate portrait of Jesus. The eagle is also thought of as soaring to the greatest heights, and this also is a good description of John. You know, in the other Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's mostly dealing with the horizontal, with the geography and the history of Israel. But John comes along and gives us the vertical. He introduces this cosmic perspective. But the story doesn't just have a cosmic perspective. It also has personal significance. Because John believes and is convinced that because of Jesus, people like you and me can begin again. We can begin again in our relationship with God. We can begin again in our relationships with each other. We can begin again to live a life that really matters. John explains this near the end of his book. In many ways, this is the very purpose of his book. He says in John 20, 30 to 31, "The disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name." Now, the signs of Jesus are important for John. In fact, the first 12 chapters of John, minus the prologue, are often referred to by scholars as the Book of Signs. The Book of Signs. Now, contrary to what you may have heard, the Book of Signs is not this compendium of secret symbolism from the Middle Ages, all right? Certainly not the latest Daniel Brown book. Nor is the Book of Signs a collection of odd displays alongside the road. This is a sign you would not usually find in Michigan. New Zealand, yes, but not Michigan. We're not talking about that kind of sign. Rather, John writes about 7 significant miracles, which he calls signs. And this forms the backbone of this gospel and is our key for exploring this beloved book. Now, the 7 signs include the wedding at Cana. We'll take a look at that next week. The healing of the official's son, the healing on the Sabbath, the feeding of the 5,000, the man who walks on water, the healing of someone born blind, the raising of Lazarus. Now, being familiar with these 7 signs then helps us to appreciate the remainder of the book, which includes the triumphal entry, the resurrection, the fate of Peter, and the beloved disciple. Those of you who are good at counting now realize that this is a 12-part series. And for those of you who are not good at counting, it's still going to be a 12-part series. I need to say just a little bit more, okay, as part of this introduction. In John's day, there was this complex of religious movements that had a lot of similarities. And later in history, they would be called Gnosticism. Another one of those words, I'm sorry. Gnosticism, all right? And we really need to know just a little bit about Gnosticism, okay? So bear with me. If we could just learn just a little bit about Gnosticism. If we don't, if we don't catch on to this, we're going to miss both the greatness of John and much of the aim of his book. Gnosticism. Well, the name is from a Greek word for knowledge. The Gnostics believed that the physical world, anything you can touch, that the physical world is evil, and only the spiritual world is good. And in order to escape the physical world into this spiritual world, you needed special knowledge, hence the term Gnostic. Gnosticism was an insidious rival to Christianity during the early centuries. And they often used, borrowed, stole, Christian symbols to represent their mystical beliefs. For Gnostics, Jesus could neither be God nor man. I mean, if you think about that, God is spirit, and spirit is good. So if physical is evil, then God is going to have nothing to do with the physical world. In fact, God, the real God, didn't even create the universe. The universe was created by some ignorant emanation far from God. On the other hand, if Jesus was good, as most of the Gnostics held, he could not have been a man, because a man is a physical human being, and anything physical is evil. Jesus couldn't have had a human form, because this would mean he was evil. So for Gnostics, Jesus was this sort of strange, in-between creature, spirit, neither divine nor a flesh and blood person. You follow that? All right. That's what the Gnostics believe. In contrast to that, you have John's ringing statement about Jesus. God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. And then later, so the Word became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. All right, so now you have a little bit of taste of this conflict. And this conflict with the Gnostics helps to explain something very unusual about the Gospel of John. John has this almost paradoxical double emphasis on Jesus. No other gospel so emphatically stresses the humanity of Jesus as John. John tells us that Jesus was angry, tired, hungry, knew grief, wept tears, and while dying on the cross, cried out, "I am thirsty." On the other hand, no other gospel so emphatically stresses the divinity of Jesus. John saw in Jesus one who had always been, even before the world began. Again and again, he speaks of his coming down from heaven. He talks of the glory which he had with the Father before the cosmos existed. He is Yahweh in human flesh. Jesus said, "I tell you the truth. Before Abraham was even born, I am. To meet the challenge of the Gnostics and their peculiar beliefs, John presents us with a Jesus who is undeniably human and undeniably God. And it's this Jesus who can give us real life. Life. Real life. The word life occurs twice as often in John as in the other three Gospels combined. John is telling us that in Jesus Christ we have new life. If you've ever longed to start over, if you've ever longed for a fresh start, if you ever desire to overcome the mistakes and the regrets of the past, if you ever hoped to be able to face the future with confident joy, then this story, John's story, well, it's for you.